This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, Australia's cooling economy. Is recession now on the cards? And why is poor productivity proving to be such a problem? Also, mass evacuations underway in southern Ukraine. We take you to Kherson, where the water levels are still rising after the destruction of a major dam upstream.
Yeah, it's just devastating right now. I see a lot of animals here. People are trying to rescue them. And yeah, the water is coming today as well.
And a highly respected former US intelligence official claims UFOs are real. Should we be taking his claims seriously? Thanks for your company. First, there's growing talk of recession amongst some of the nation's most prominent economists as global uncertainty, cost of living pressures, and higher interest rates continue to weigh down on the economy. National GDP figures out today show economic growth rose by just 0.2% in the first 3 months of this year. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says he's not surprised by the numbers.
The data also confirms a view that we've had for some time, which is inflation is moderating from its peak. Not as fast as we would like, and it will hang around for higher than we'd like, for longer than we'd like, but there is more evidence in this data today that inflation is moderating from its peak of around Christmas time.
Jim Chalmers there. So what do these latest figures tell us about the health or otherwise of the economy? I spoke to Warren Hogan, the economic advisor to Judo Bank.
The slowdown is underway in 2023. It really does reinforce this concern and potential for us to experience a mild technical recession at some stage in the next year or so. The economy is only just growing, and of course, with rates continuing to go up, we may see the economy go backwards for two consecutive quarters. Now, I do not anticipate that that will be a severe contraction. The recession sort of that we fear with widespread business failures and surging unemployment. I think it's a very mild recession we could experience. But nonetheless, I think today's figures really reinforce that we're really skirting with technical recession in this country. In terms of the health of the economy, the most worrying feature, as we've been hearing more about in the last few weeks from the governor of the RBA, is the weak productivity performance. We've actually seen an almost 5% decline in the productivity of the economy in the last year, and that's one of the weakest periods on record.
That's Warren Hogan from Judo Bank there. So what actually is productivity and how can we improve it? The answer most likely lies with automation and artificial intelligence playing a greater role in the economy, and this could have serious implications for workers and their jobs. Fatima Alumi prepared this report.
If you've heard any economic news lately, productivity seems to be a word used a lot by politicians and economists. But what does it mean in relation to the economy? Here's senior economist with the Australia Institute, Matt Grundoff.
It's producing more with the same amount of stuff. So if a company or the economy as a whole can produce more output for the same amount of resources, then we say that productivity has gone up.
By resources, he means workers. If a certain number of employees can produce more work without their employer having to hire more people, this means the company is productive. The latest GDP figures indicate Australia is lagging behind on productivity. The main measure to gauge this is the GDP per hour worked. That tells us the amount of work people get done per hour, and that figure has dropped by 4.6% from March last year to March this year. Matt Grundoff says this number has been going backwards for the last 10 years. What it means is the employers aren't keeping up, not that employees aren't working hard enough.
Workers almost have no control over productivity. Why is that? Because productivity improves when the organisation of the business gets better, or the amount of technology or capital equipment that the worker has to work with improves.
So in practical terms, how might this play out in the Australian workforce of the future? For many working in an office, the mounting pile of things to do is often dominated by tedious tasks. It's gotten to a point where simple things like replying to an email can be a mission and a waste of time that you could be using to something more productive.
We're trying to focus on work having less mundane and administrative focus and more creative and innovation focus.
Jane McEroe is Microsoft's Director of Surface and Modern Work in Australia. Big tech companies like hers are at the forefront of changing work as we know it. Their latest project involves a new program called Copilot, which is embedded into apps like Word and PowerPoint to help employees get work done faster.
You don't want to be on autopilot. You want them to be working with you. So you apply your higher order insight and your higher order thinking to that PowerPoint.
What Microsoft is saying is that programs like these are a way to boost productivity.
I spend a lot of time sitting in meetings. Often I don't even know what the agenda is. Often I'm late to them because I run around like a mad woman trying to get to them all. If you are late to a meeting that you might be having on something, you'll be able to actually press a button that says Copilot that will then summarise what has happened in the meeting so far.
One thing's for certain, artificial intelligence and automation will play a big role in the push for greater productivity. Here's Toby Walsh, Chief Scientist at the University of New South Wales AI Institute.
There's great promise from these new technologies like generative AI to improve productivity in the office as well. There's lots of things that we do, writing emails and answering people, which we can get these tools to increase our productivity.
The words artificial intelligence and automation scare many workers. Fearful they'll be replaced by robots or software. But experts say more technology doesn't necessarily mean bad news for workers. Professor Toby Walsh says this fear is justified. However, he also sees many benefits if the transformation is handled with humanity.
We should certainly be concerned about the displacement of people's jobs. New technology has always created new jobs. Indeed, it's created more new jobs than it's ever destroyed. But those new jobs that get created will require different skills than the old jobs. We have to provide incentives to the individual, incentives to businesses to help people through what can be a very difficult time.
The Reserve Bank and Australia's best economic minds would be well aware of these future trends. But the big concern they'd also have is how we can boost productivity now.
That report from Fatima Alumi. A mass evacuation is underway in southern Ukraine after the collapse of a major dam on the Dnipro River put more than 40,000 people at risk of flooding. At an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, Russia and Ukraine accused each other of being responsible, while the US says it's still unsure about what happened. Concerns remain about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which uses water from the dam reservoir for cooling. It's also a source of water for farmers, putting Ukraine's supply of wheat and corn to the world in doubt. The global price of both has soared today. Diana Butsko, a Ukrainian journalist with Hromadske, is in Kherson, where the waters are rising.
The city is on the left bank, but the dam itself was on the right bank. Still, even the left bank is getting flooded, and the water is coming. So people are leaving the area. There are a lot of rescue workers working here, also the police and others trying to help people. And the situation is very devastating, I would say, because, you know, you see people crying. A lot of them lost houses. A friend of mine from Kherson reported that he lost also to his apartments and so on and so on. Yes, it's just devastating. Right now I see a lot of animals here. People are trying to rescue them. And yeah, the water is coming today as well.
Just how high are the floodwaters and what sort of damage are they causing?
So it depends. As I say, I'm in Kherson, but also there are villages, small settlements around the area that are most damaged. There are like entire villages from that what we saw from the images that are underwater right now. So the water is coming and they say that today will be like the most dangerous day. And they say that probably yesterday, like they usually say in 3 days, the water might go away.
And so how are people being evacuated?
Yes, so it's kind of like a little bit chaotic because a lot of people are trying to help right now. A lot of people write to Kherson, also local people are trying to help. So we see this combination of the government working here, local government working here, police, military also, and also a lot of volunteers. I think the most horrific situation is on the left bank that is occupied by Russia, because from that what we saw in different public groups on social media, people ask for help, and they say that no one is coming to rescue them. So the Ukrainian government can't go there, right, because it's the occupied territories. And also, from that, what we heard from local people there, no one is rescuing them, and they've been waiting on their roofs, like, from entire night. And I see this note coming from relatives, I guess, living in Ukraine right now, like, please save our relatives, but no one can access the area. So I don't know how it will go, but yeah, it's not helpful at all.
Russia and Ukraine are blaming each other for the destruction of this dam. One of the things that the Russian side is claiming is, why would they blow up a dam that badly affects the territory that they hold? What do you and others on your side say to that?
Yeah, I definitely believe that it was done by Russia, because who else, and like, why Ukraine would do that? When Russia started targeting Ukrainian infrastructure, we were scared of that, because they targeted nuclear power plants, and we were also thinking about other dams. And what I was told by experts, that it's highly impossible to destroy a dam by a missile. So the only possible way to do it, and that's what we saw from the images, it was blown up by some explosive, I get installed by someone right there. That's what the Soviets did during the Second World War there. Russia have access to that area. I don't believe that Ukrainian resistance could have done this, because I am quite sure that this area was very guarded. There were a lot of soldiers, Russian soldiers, watching the area. So I don't see how it was possible, like, practically to do it.
And more broadly, how is this going to impact on Ukraine and the world in the longer term?
That's a very good question. What we can predict, at least for now, that ecological damage will be enormous. And I think this is a topic that should be researched and watched very closely, because, like, we don't know how it will affect the area. We know that it won't be possible to use this area for agriculture. A lot of people will leave the area, and of course their houses are destroyed. So yeah, but I think when it comes to environment, it should be more deeply, it should be researched.
That's Ukrainian journalist Diana Butsko speaking to us from Kherson. This is PM. I'm David Lipson. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. As a parliamentary inquiry continues its scrutiny of the PwC tax leaks scandal, another major consultancy firm, KPMG, has condemned the actions of its competitor as unacceptable. The Australian Federal Police is investigating allegations a former PwC partner passed on confidential information about government tax reforms to benefit the firm and its clients. KPMG says it's open to the corporate watchdog ASIC having greater oversight of consultancy firms. Samantha Donovan reports.
The shock revelation a former PwC partner misused confidential government information for profit has triggered an AFP investigation and a Senate inquiry into the integrity of consulting services. Along with PwC, Ernst & Young and Deloitte, KPMG is one of the so-called Big Four firms. Andrew Yates is the CEO of KPMG Australia. Giving evidence to the inquiry today, he called the actions of rival PwC disturbing.
Based on the findings of the Tax Practitioners Board and the more recent revelations from Senate estimates, the conduct of PwC was clearly unethical and unacceptable.
But Andrew Yates acknowledged KPMG Australia isn't perfect, having been involved in a training exam cheating scandal and in controversial work for a New South Wales transport asset entity known as TAHI. Mr. Yates gave evidence KPMG is proposing three reforms that could help restore the public's trust in the consultancy profession.
First, we propose a review and strengthening of the tax advisory firm governance and best practice principles. The principles reflect the high expectations the public has of tax advisors, but we think they could go further to strengthen governance and accountability. Secondly, we recommend the introduction of an integrity charter for working with the Australian Public Service. At the end of every piece of work, the government could assess compliance with the charter. Third, and most importantly, KPMG is supportive of a government review into whether ASIC should have an extended regulatory role over our profession.
Andrew Yates told the inquiry KPMG supports the federal government's plan to rebuild the capacity of the public service, and the firm hasn't tendered for the government's Labor Hire Services panel and won't participate in that sort of work in future. Labor Senator Deborah O'Neill asked him if Australia should have a register of consultants working at the big firms to keep track of where they've worked before, including the public service, and any potential conflicts of interest.
Because we're hearing a lot about this cross-contamination, indeed, that there's active recruiting of senior people from the ATO by firms such as yourself to bring that knowledge into your business and to expedite the movement of that knowledge in a way that's an advantage to the profit of KPMG.
The very reason that government engages firms like ours is for the expertise that we have in our organisation that is developed by doing different types of work. If government feels that a register of consultants is another step in the right way to sort of oversight this, we'd welcome that. But I would point out that we have in our firm something in the order of 7,000 consultants. I don't think it would be manageable across the whole consulting industry to have a register of consultants.
The committee's next public hearings are scheduled for July.
Samantha Donovan there. Environment groups are questioning one of the biggest commitments of the federal government's $120 billion infrastructure program, a new gas, petrochemicals and possibly renewable energy precinct in Darwin. Both the federal and NT governments have denied it's predominantly a gas project, but promotional videos and plans for the project have cast some doubt on those claims. Jane Barden reports.
The NT government put its pitch for $1.5 billion for a massive industrial precinct with six export wharves on Darwin Harbour to the federal government last year, sending it briefing documents and a promotional video.
The Middle Arm Sustainable Development Precinct will be the home for low emissions hydrocarbons, green hydrogen.
It's a huge project. Federal Labor made Middle Arm its second biggest infrastructure funding commitment after Victoria's suburban rail loop. Both governments have stressed it would host fossil fuel and green industries. But the NT government's video has touted it as a place where gas from its planned Beetaloo Basin fracking field could be processed and made into petrochemicals and blue hydrogen.
The Beetaloo sub-basin has globally significant gas reserves that could propel advanced manufacturing.
The video is online. The version sent to the Commonwealth by the NT government also names several gas and petrochemicals companies as Middle Arm tenants. The NT Environment Centre got that video and briefing documents from the Federal Infrastructure Department through a Freedom of Information request. Centre Director Kirsty Howie.
We've discovered that the Australian taxpayer is funding $1.5 billion of gas infrastructure, the costs of which should be borne by the gas industry, not the Australian taxpayer.
The NT Chief Minister, Natasha Files, is adamant the funding is justified.
It is not a predominantly gas facility. Is it a sustainable precinct so that we can have jobs?
The information videos that you have on your website about the Middle Arm and also the briefing materials that the government provided to the federal government to get the funding commitment say really that the key tenants for the Middle Arm are going to be Tamboran, Inpex, Santos is also mentioned, and that a lot of the gas coming to there would be from the Beetaloo. Is that still the case or has something changed?
Middle Arm will be a sustainable precinct for both jobs here in the Territory for manufacturing, but also around making sure that we can utilise new technologies and provide energy not only to the Northern Territory, but around Australia and the world.
The Chief Minister says proof the development will include green industries is a $1 million federal grant awarded today to gas companies Inpex and Santos to assess whether hydrogen could be produced at Middle Arm.
When people try and write this off, that this is fossil fuel companies, you can do that, you can grab your headline, but this is also backed by CSIRO.
But the Inpex general manager, Stuart Knowles, couldn't say if the hydrogen would be made with gas or water.
Would you be hopeful of making blue hydrogen or green hydrogen?
The study's going to look at all of the options, including domestic, Australian and international market opportunities.
The ABC asked the Federal Infrastructure Minister, Catherine King, to comment. The NT government and INPEX's Stuart Knowles say more gas can be developed without adding to climate change by trapping greenhouse emissions underground offshore from the Middle Arm precinct. They can't yet say if that will be viable.
We're looking at reducing our emissions through carbon capture and storage. There is a massive opportunity for the Northern Territory in that space.
Is there any indication the economics of it could stack up at the moment?
It's critical to reducing our emissions that we look at carbon capture and storage opportunities, and that's what we're doing.
That's INPEX manager Stuart Knowles speaking to Jane Barden. Well, it appears youth crime has come to Tasmania's capital in a major way. A high-visibility police task force has been set up in Hobart's CBD amid concerns of an increase in antisocial behaviour. Retailers are particularly worried about youth offenders, and the task force has homed in on young people. Children's advocates, though, say it's a punitive approach that fails to address the social issues underpinning the behaviour. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Life is never easy for small business owners, especially if you're repeatedly targeted by thieves. It's a serious problem for Netta Robustelli, who runs a pharmacy in the Hobart suburb of Sandy Bay.
We've noticed a lot of young, maybe 14, 15-year-olds, lurking around, scoping the place out, kind of making my staff feel a bit scared, and they just walk around and then, you know, the next day or the day after they come in and steal stuff.
Netta Robustelli has called the police several times and even banned hoodie jumpers from being worn in store.
I just think it's pretty unfair that we are, you know, open long hours, open on weekends and public holidays, and we're there to serve the community, and we have to be worried about, you know, people coming in and making my staff scared to come to work, and they shouldn't have to feel like that.
Youth-related crime is an issue of growing concern in Hobart, and one police take increasingly seriously. Early last month, a high-visibility police task force hit the streets in response to growing concerns from retailers. Tasmania Police says more than 20 people have since been arrested, and many more directed to leave the area. The vast majority were young people. A 16-year-old has been charged over an alleged armed robbery earlier this week, and in February, a 13-year-old was charged with attempted murder over an alleged stabbing at a department store. Rob White is an Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Criminology at the University of Tasmania.
I think that we put way too much pressure on the police to somehow magically solve a problem that has its origins and roots in just wider social conditions and social processes.
Professor White says youth crime is a complex problem with many causes and often no clear solutions.
We know that there's difficulties with housing and homelessness. There's difficulties with jobs and wages. But there's also really quite horrible stuff happening on the internet.
Professor White suggests a better response might be to engage more youth and community workers in problem areas.
We've got to think a lot more creatively about how we're going to deal with issues of perceived, at least, youth crime and the moral panics over young people.
In recent years, Tasmania's economy has diversified and strengthened, but in many areas it still struggles. Incomes lag the rest of the country, and there's a severe housing shortage. Many people also struggle to access good health services. Tasmania's Children's Commissioner is Leanne McLean.
So young people don't wake up one morning and say, right, today is the day that I'm going to go out and undertake harmful behaviour that's harmful to me, that's harmful to the people around me. It happens when the systems and the supports and the services that we rely on to support families who then support children are not working.
Ms. McLean says extra investment in support services would help address the issue long term. At the moment, she says Tasmania's emergency housing, health, mental health and drug and alcohol services for young people are lacking.
These things are all incredibly difficult to access. So children fall through the gaps. Young people fall through the gaps. And yet what we've seen solely as the response so far in Tasmania is more police on the beat. And that is incredibly disappointing because there's never been a better example really of an ambulance at the bottom of a cliff.
How much do you think the current housing crisis and things like the rising cost of living are having an impact on this?
I think they're having a significant impact. As the person who is the advocate for young people in detention in Tasmania, I can tell you many of them are homeless. They don't have a safe and stable place to call home, and that includes young people who are under the care and protection of the state. But the housing situation has gotten significantly worse.
The Tasmanian government says the community expects police to respond to crime, and it's developing a youth justice blueprint to better support young people at risk. It will focus on a number of strategies, including early intervention, diversion from the justice system, and taking a therapeutic approach.
Alexandra Humphreys, our reporter there. Now, our next story is about UFOs, but before you roll your eyes and change the dial, consider who is making the latest claims. A senior and highly respected former US military analyst who says his government is in possession of intact and partially intact craft of non-human origin. David Grush says the information is being illegally withheld from Congress, and he's lodged a formal whistleblower complaint saying the US government has collected non-human aircraft for decades. Tom Melville has the details.
David Grush was a highly trained intelligence officer for the US Department of Defense. He worked for the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force. Essentially, it was his job to investigate claims of UFOs. Speaking to Australian journalist Ross Coulthard on the US cable news channel News Nation, he says the US government's been collecting alien aircraft for decades.
When you say crash retrieval, what do you mean?
These are retrieving non-human origin technical vehicles, you know, call it spacecraft if you will, non-human, exotic origin vehicles that have either landed or crashed.
We have spacecraft from another species.
We do, yeah.
How many?
Quite a number.
You're kidding.
No.
And he says not all interactions between humans and aliens have been peaceful.
Have human beings been hurt or killed by a non-human intelligence?
While I can't get into the specifics because that would reveal certain U.S. classified operations, I was briefed by a few individuals on the program that there were malevolent events like that.
Mr. Grush says he hasn't personally seen the aircraft he's mentioned. So what do we make of his claims? Usually people who claim the existence of UFOs can be dismissed as conspiracy theorists. Former US officials, though, have vouched for Mr. Grush's credibility, with one retired US Army colonel calling Mr. Grush beyond reproach. John Blaxland is a former intelligence analyst and is now Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University.
Normally when we teach my students, when I'm rating sources, I rate them for accuracy and reliability. And this is somebody who has a track record of being reliable. And yet on this issue, there is enormous question about accuracy. So, yes, I'm not challenging this person's integrity. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm saying show me the evidence.
So why did David Grush come forward with these claims? One of the main reasons, he says, is that Congress is being kept in the dark and that there are serious national security implications.
We're in a competition with their adversaries to understand this. And it's a multi-decade Cold War that has been under our nose for so long. And, you know, there is no good way to level the playing field and hold other nation states accountable if they're doing unethical or illicit activity as it relates to this subject. And I think the obtuse secrecy is actually putting us in a very dangerous position.
Professor John Blaxland says David Grush clearly seems to have credibility with some in the US intelligence sector. But he insists that until he and the world sees credible evidence, we should remain sceptical.
I can completely understand the concern and would recognise that China and Russia would also be interested in observing these indications of extraterrestrial phenomena. That makes a lot of sense. The question is, so what? Where's the evidence?
And Mr. Grush says it's not just the US with an alien aircraft crash retrieval program. Its adversaries are also desperate to learn what military advantages might be gained by learning the secrets of any extraterrestrial visitors. Meanwhile, Washington is taking UFOs, officially UAPs, more seriously. NASA has just held the first public meeting of its new committee tasked with studying UAPs and said stigma around reporting strange sightings has contributed to a lack of reliable data.
Tom Melville with that report. Well, that's the program for today. Thanks for joining us on PM. I'm David Lipson. You can head to the PM webpage for all of our interviews and reports to share. And you can always catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. Don't forget to check out ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley. That's each weekday morning. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for your company. Good night.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The Reserve Bank has hit borrowers with yet another interest rate rise, and there's concern last week's decision to increase the minimum wage could further fuel inflation, pushing rates even higher. Today, business and economics reporter Gareth Hutchins on whether or not the wage increase signals there's more pain to come. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listener.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.